And 3, 2, 1. Oh, welcome back.
Hope you're more excited than Cam is.
Ladies and gentlemen, to the Life of Caesar podcast, episode 12, Ray just reminded me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. 11 plus 1.
And I have to say, this is where it starts to get good. I mean, everything that's happened in Caesar's life up to now, Ray, has been just a preamble. I mean, he's had a fairly average life and career for Roman aristocracy. About now is where things start to fall into place. The Caesar that we know and love starts to kick in. Would you agree?
Yes, except for one caveat. I think his sex life was probably above average. But other than that, yes, pretty much the aristocracy would do. But he is going to enter a phase that, for those people who don't like him or maybe are not as enthusiastic about him as we are, what we're going to talk about tonight is one of the reasons probably why that this side of Caesar, the darker side of Caesar, might kind of repel some people. But he's still a fascinating person. You can't deny that.
You cannot deny that. Yeah. And I'm going to tell you something that will make him seem even more fascinating. Before we get into the next chapter of the story. So we've got this listener, Arne Sigurdsson. I'm pretty sure that's not how you pronounce it, but Arne's been a loyal listener of other stuff that I've done for years, Napoleon, etc. He's from Iceland, I think. Lovely fellow. Follows me on Twitter and Facebook. We chat. He's always sending me links to stuff. Like every day I get a link from something. Actually, Arne reviewed us, I think, in iTunes in Icelandish. Is that what you call the language in Iceland? Icelandish?
It is now.
Icelandia. I don't know. But anyway. He wrote a review on Facebook in Icelandish or so. Anyway. We thank you, Arne, for your support. So anyway, Arne's been sending me these links in the last week to a book by a guy called Francesco Carota, who has a theory that I thought you would enjoy. And, you know, some listeners will enjoy, some won't, but, you know. Mm-hmm. That Julius Caesar, JC, actually became the other JC. Jesus Christ. He says that he's written this book that says that Jesus Christ is actually a mythologization of Julius Caesar. Now, on the surface of it, you may go nonsense, which is what I did. And then I started to read the summary. There's a video on YouTube, which I haven't seen yet, but I did start to read some of his reasoning for this, and it's kind of fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's really – and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I'll just run down quickly some of the parallels. We know that, as we've covered off in the show previously, that Julius Caesar said that his family was descended from Venus. I think it was at his aunt Julia's funeral in that speech. He sort of talked about how they were descended from the gods. So he was, you know, the son of a god. And after he died, he was elevated to the status of imperial god. So he was born of the gods and also a god himself after his death. Jesus died around Easter, supposedly. When did Caesar die? Ides of March, right?
Aha.
Judas betrayed Jesus.
Ooh.
Decimus Junius Brutus. Judas Brutus betrayed Caesar. Mm-hmm. Brute. Caesar came down to Rome from Gaul. Jesus came down from Galilee. Caesar said, "He who does not take sides is on my side." Jesus says, "For he that is not against us is for us." Caesar said, "I am not king, I am Caesar." Jesus says, "We have no king but Caesar." Caesar says, "The best death is sudden death." Jesus says, "What you are going to do, do quickly," when he's being led to this. Caesar wore the oak leaf crown. Jesus wears the thorn crown, crown of thorns. Caesar was Pontifex Maximus. Jesus was supposedly some sort of itinerant preacher. Caesar was the Pope of Rome.
Yeah.
But here's the best one. How good your Christian history?
It's okay, solid.
So supposedly when Jesus was on the cross, some Roman centurion comes up and stabs him in the side with a spear.
Mm-hmm.
What was the name of the guy?
Oh, God. Longinus?
No. Yes.
Okay.
And the famous Longinus or Longinus spear supposedly has magical powers. Hitler or Indiana Jones or somebody was trying to find it.
Hitler was all about that, but that's enough for another show.
Yeah. the leader of the conspiracy of the senators that killed Caesar, Gaius Cassius Longinus.
Wow.
Who stabbed Caesar in the side.
Wow. That's freaking me. I am freaked out right now.
I can tell you're freaked out.
I'm looking around. I'm in a room by myself, but I'm looking over my shoulder because I don't make sure I'm alone here. That's freaking me out.
So anyway, Francesco Corona, I don't know, man. Have you ever heard that before, the parallels, the JC parallel?
No, that was the way they lined up, and I'm going to check that out.
And there's a lot more to it as well. Please, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not taking this seriously, but I think it's fascinating. Right. I was just mostly surprised that I'm fascinated about New Testament history, biblical history, and how it all came together. I've never heard that theory before, which with that amount of sort of weird parallels, you would think I would have heard of it before.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now that all the fundamentalist Christians have turned off, let's get on to Gaul.
Right, the other JC, Julius Caesar.
What happened? Let's recap at the end of episode 11. What happened? Can you remember? It's 2 weeks ago.
I'll do the best I can. How's that?
Right.
So his consulship is over. It was an unqualified success. Now he has to go to his province. He's age 41. But he doesn't leave Rome until March of 58 BCE to make sure that all those laws he had put in kind of stay intact. Because the longer they sit there, the more established they are, and someone might not try to mess with them. So he stays in there until March, and he's ready to take off. So he's done what he needs to do for Pompey, and now Pompey is married to his daughter, so that's locked up. He's done what he needs to do for Crassus, but him and Crassus have been friends for a long time, so that's secure. But now it's time for Caesar to get what he decides is coming to him. Everything he's done his entire life, this is where he is going to be to do things to be remembered in the history books. This is his time.
And he said that he was going to mount the heads of his enemies, mount on their heads, I think.
Right.
Mount, which we were struggling with understanding exactly what that means, but it's not good, whatever it is.
Good for him, bad for them.
Yeah. So he's going to Gaul. Now, we talked about last time the territories that he ended up getting. Listeners will remember that originally, at the start of his consulship, he was supposed to end up with some wooded laneways of country Italy. What he's actually got is Cisalpine Gaul, Illyricum, and Transalpine Gaul, or Gallia Narbonensis, as it's also known. Now, I didn't know where these places were. I mean, my only knowledge of Gaul is from Asterix and Obelix comics. So I looked it up. I was like, all right, let's pull up a map. We're like, where did what kind of area was Caesar governor of here? Oh my God. Yeah. Like, what a gig. No wonder he didn't go back for 9 years. I mean,
that's right.
So basically, for those of you who don't know, This is everything from the northern part of Italy, pretty much the rest of Europe, all the good bits. Anyway, it's basically, you know, most of France, Switzerland, Luxembourg, Belgium, parts of the Netherlands and Germany, right through to like Croatia, Illyricum included, sort of Albania, Croatia, Bosnia, Herzegovina.
Right.
This was like what an amazing. I mean, it's amazing now. Imagine what it was like. Apart from the stinking Gauls that he had to deal with, imagine what it was like in 58, 59 BCE.
58, yeah.
I mean, what an amazing gig. Yeah?
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that he kind of expected, or at least thought, until that one governor died and he got his area too, that his action would be in the Balkans. But the way things are going to turn out, it's going to be in Gaul. So you got, you know, in northern Italy, you got Cisalpine Gaul. Then you got Transalpine Gaul, which is the path to go from Italy to Spain. So he's got all this territory and it goes all the way to the Rhine River, you know, to the east. So there's this huge, huge territory. But if anybody can administer, if I can use that word, it's someone like Gaius Caesar, who absolutely loves to work. He doesn't waste any time. He has his secretaries, and he is going. He knows exactly what he wants to do. And I don't know if you want to jump into it just yet, but for those people who aren't crazy about Caesar, he is going to, even though he's been breaking some rules all his life, he's going to break a very big rule. He is going to go on the offensive, and he is going to go there to more or less start a war so he can have lots of battles, so he can be a great general and get lots of slaves and sell them and make tons of money, because remember, he still owes a ton of money. And he wants to outclips his son-in-law, Pompey. So the question is, where is he going to get all this money? Well, his son-in-law. Yeah, he wants to outclips his son-in-law, which is kind of freaky because the guy was 6 years older. But anyway, But even though we barely touched on it, when it was Aletes, and I can't remember his title, but Aletes of Egypt bribes or gives money to Caesar to pass certain laws for him. And so Caesar knows that he's not going to be able to go to the Roman Senate that can't stand him and get a whole bunch of money to go start a war in the first place. So he's going to have to use his part of the money that he got from that to get this operation going, because he's going to need more men. He's going to need more material, swords, shields, horses, just everything you could possibly need for a war, much less to govern all these provinces. So he's got this plan. He's got his cash. He's going to get it going. And then when he starts making money and when he starts doing well, he's going to write about it himself. He's going to praise himself. He's going to send letters back to Rome. He's going to be his own propaganda minister, if you will. But he has this plan, but it's just so audacious. And the land that he has to deal with is so huge and so populous. I think everybody else would have just went, there's no way this can possibly succeed.
Yeah, and I also want to point out that it's important to understand that these regions had been sort of annexed by Rome for well over a century before Caesar got there. Right, they were sort of, you know, I think mid-second century they had been annexed after the Gauls attacked Rome and the Romans went in, and they had a few struggles with them, but it wasn't like Caesar went out to conquer Gaul. It had already been conquered for generations. He was going out to govern, to manage it, but that wasn't enough for Julie.
Right. Right.
Just in terms, I mean, I don't want to bury the lead or shortcut it, but during his governorship, one source I read said that as many as a million people probably died. Mm-hmm. One in five of the Gauls died.
Yeah.
Another million were enslaved. 300 clans were subjugated and 800 cities destroyed during the Gallic Wars. The entire population of the city of Avaricum, 40,000 people, it's estimated, were killed. During his campaign against the Helvetii in present-day Switzerland, 60% of the nation was destroyed and another 20% taken into slavery. So,
wow.
I mean, yeah, as you say, like, guy went nuts.
Yeah. Now, and you probably feel the same way I do, Cameron. Even though we all generally know what's going to happen, it's more, quite frankly, entertaining, but also more accurate to pretend like we don't know what's going to happen. So he's leaving Rome, and all that pretty much anybody knows is that he had a pretty successful consulship. The things that they didn't agree with, guess what? He got away with. And now he's they're assuming he's going to spend the rest of his life, you know, securing his legacy, doing what he has to do so he can be in the books, so he can be a senator for a long time and maybe one day a censor, and he's going to die in that scene of his life. So everybody just assumes he's going to kind of fade out into the sun, you know, govern this place well. Maybe there's some battles, but they're just assuming that everything that made them nervous about Caesar is over with. And now they can kind of get on with their lives, and they survived his consulship. But of course, we all know that there's nothing like that is going to happen.
Yeah, as you say, it's very hard from our modern perspective to think about Caesar in this period like he, you know, would have been seen by his contemporaries. They, you know, one of the things that's interesting is when he went off to Gaul, he had to take, you know, his legates with him to assist him to govern such a huge territory. And he really didn't get anyone of note. I mean, nobody who was anybody really wanted to go with him. I mean, surprises me a little bit, but I mean, he wasn't, oh my God, Julius Caesar, yeah, we're going to go and be part of that because that's going to lead to big things. Most of the people that went with him to assist him were, you know, Roman nobodies at the time.
Right. We should probably mention some of their names, because even though these names are going to change for the next 9 years, just so that you're familiar with them, and a lot of people probably know some of their names, like Labienus, the one who is having the affair with Pompey's wife. Well, Caesar was having an affair with Pompey's wife. He becomes up until a point, he becomes Caesar's right-hand man. So remember the name Labienus, and of course Balbus, who was taking care of his finances when he was in Spain, is going to go with him. He's going to be like his, is that Fabrum? I'm not sure how to say that, but he's going to handle his money and things like that. There's Ventinius, who is the one who got Caesar the 5-year command of Gaul. We'll also run across a Quintus Pedius, Aulus Hirtius, Quintus Titus Sabinus. And that came out wrong, but you know what I said. But these are all, and of course, Crassus' son. I thought that was interesting. Publius Crassus, the son of the Crassus, is going to be there as well. So we're going to throw out a lot of names, and we'll do the best we can to differentiate them over the next 9 years of Caesar's life.
And of course, 99.9% of the information that we have about this period of Caesar's life comes from one of the great, great, great works. Why are you laughing? It is. It's
I thought you were going to say one of the great, great. No, I thought you were going to say one of the great, great, great writers. Caesar, yeah.
I mean, as people probably know, Caesar wrote his own commentaries on the Gallic Wars, which we still have. It's one of the very few. Well, in a lot of ways, it's one of the very few books from that era that we have. Certainly, the only commentary on wars written by a general commanding officer that has survived, even though that was apparently a fairly common thing. But it's also, it's famous apparently for anyone who studies Latin. It has always been famous as one of the best works to be written in non-flowery Latin, and was received very well in his own time. Even, you know, people like Cicero complimented the style of the writing of the books. I think there was 10 in all. Seven dealing with Gaul, and then he wrote some more dealing with the Civil War, another three later. But so Caesar was writing his own story, and we've talked a bit before about propaganda, Caesar and propaganda, and you know, writing your own story about your wars is obviously a good way to accomplish that. There's some debate about whether or not he wrote all 7 books at the end of the Gallic Wars, or if he actually wrote them after each year, He would, you know, major period. He, during the winters, in his downtime, he may have written what had happened in the last year and sent it off to the Senate as a report, and it formed the basis of the Gallic Wars. Historians don't really know which of those scenarios, but either way, he wrote it himself, did a terrific job. And the interesting thing is, I don't know if you've how much of this you've read, but he famously refers to himself in the third person. I've got a section here from the first book that I will read with your permission.
Please.
Oh, thank you, Ray.
Yeah.
Ah, all right. And so this it says, when Caesar was informed by spies that the Helvetii had already conveyed three parts of their forces across that river, but that the fourth part was left behind on this side of the Saon, he set out from the camp with three legions during the third watch and came up with that division which had not yet crossed the river. Attacking them, encumbered with baggage and not expecting him, he cut to pieces a great part of them. The rest betook themselves to flight and concealed themselves in the nearest woods. That canton which was cut down was called the Tigurine, for the whole Helvetian state is divided into four cantons. The single canton, having left their country within the recollection of our fathers, had slain Lucius Cassius the consul and had made his army pass under the yoke. Thus, whether by chance or by the design of the immortal gods, that part of the Helvetian state which had brought a signal calamity upon the Roman people was the first to pay the penalty. In this, Caesar avenged not only the public, but also his own personal wrongs, because the Tigurini had slain Lucius Piso, the lieutenant of Cassius, the grandfather of Lucius Calpurnius Piso, his father-in-law, in the same battle as Cassius himself. So you can see from that little segment that Caesar's A, talking about himself in the third person, like it's a third-party objective document. B, you know, he's sort of saying things like Caesar avenged the public, you know, whether or not it was by chance or the design of the immortal gods. He's I mean, it's beautifully written, and he's really selling himself right through. So obviously, you know, what we know about this period is from Caesar's own writing mostly. And everyone understands that when a, you know, commander writes his own story, or like when anyone writes their own autobiography, you got to take it somewhat with a grain of salt. However, the consensus from historians seems to be that most of what he's written here is probably mostly accurate in terms of what happened, the ups and downs of the battles and the wars, even though you know, he may have embellished a little bit.
Sure.
They believe it was probably mostly factual because even though most people in this day and age were probably illiterate, he wouldn't be able to get away with telling too many porky pies in his reports to the Senate because people would have called him on his bullshit, right? So it's I thought we had to put that out there, that most of what we know is from Caesar himself. And when people say to you, well, you know, nobody wrote anything back in those days and we have no first-hand accounts of anyone who lived in ancient Rome, well, we do. So we have Caesar's own writing. He wrote his own version of events, which is kind of amazing that we still have it. We've lost so much of anything that was written. You know, we have scraps of stuff that was written usually back then, but this was such an important document or series of documents, of books, that it managed to survive, which is lucky for us, right?
Well, I don't think luck had anything to do with it. I think Jupiter Optimus Maximus decided that those works would last throughout the year. So I think we all owe Big Jupe a big thank you for making sure those books lasted. So no, but the guy he literally relied on luck a lot, which I don't know if that's just a different form of ego or whatever. But as far as his writing goes, the most negative comment I came upon was sometimes if something went wrong, he would blame someone else. But as far as the events, the people he fought and things like that, he pretty much, you know, kept to what really happened because he had to, because there were so many other people around as well. But I just thought it was neat that he wrote in the third person. And if you read it, it reads like the script for a good action movie. You know, we did this, and then they did this, and I had to do this, and it just reads really well. And once it got back to Rome, you just had to think people were going, "Oh hell yeah, here comes the next installment of Caesar's story." It probably worked great as a propaganda tool.
Yeah, and again, we need to keep in mind as we go through this period that even though this was a big event, period of his life, he still wasn't finished. I mean, he knew that he was setting himself up for the next act, even though he'd already been consul and he had his governorship. You know, he was always thinking ahead about how he was going to be perceived and how to grow his power base in Rome. I've got some stuff here that Cicero said about the commentaries. They are admirable indeed, like naked forms, upright and beautiful, paired of all ornamentation as if they had removed a robe. Yet while he wished to provide other authors with the means for writing history, he may only have succeeded in pleasing the incompetent who might like to apply their gifts to his material, for he has deterred all sane men from writing, for there is nothing better in the writing of history than clear and distinguished brevity. Now, I hasten to point out that Cicero wrote those words while Caesar was dictator, so
context is everything. Yeah. I like to take a very famous saying and twist it a little bit. And brevity is the soul of good history written. Like I said, he used nouns and he used verbs and he kept the action going and he just boom, 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 went from one event to the other. And that does make for solid writing, especially compared to someone like Cicero, who was very flowery and very dramatic and stuff like that. But for him to like it, even though it's the opposite of how he would write, I think that says something, even though, yeah, like you said, it was during the time when Caesar pretty much controlled everybody's lives.
Yeah, and without wanting to switch periods too quickly, but, this book also played a very big role, I think, in the future of commanders understanding the role that, you know, their own propaganda could play. Napoleon was a great admirer of Caesar's. He studied his campaigns and, you know, obviously learnt a lot from him in terms of writing his own history, even though Napoleon never went to the lengths of writing something like the commentaries, but he had, you know, he had other people around him writing his versions of their battles, and he had his own newspaper and stuff like that. I was looking for a quote that's Caesar's. You might have it there about how to write good action scenes. Do you have that quote?
No.
Ah, I've got it. Let me look at it. It's something like Just hold on.
Sure.
Hold on. I'll edit this out later. Oh, here we go. On one occasion, this isn't about writing his commentaries, but Caesar had once said that an orator should avoid an unusual word as the helmsman of a ship avoided a reef.
Yeah, I remember that.
So no big words, no complex words in your own. Just
boom, boom, boom.
Just get to it. What did Cicero say? Like naked as if the unadorned of the robe or something.
Yeah.
That's nice. All right. Anyway.
Naked.
Yeah. Naked history.
Naked history. I like that. We should have called this the naked history of Caesar. But anyway, so eventually when Caesar gets going, he's going to have he's going to have four legions, the 7th, the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th. And of course, it's the 10th that will play a big role in what's to come. What I thought was really neat, and Cameron, please jump in at any time. What I thought was really neat was that we all know that the legionary was the core, was the basis of the Roman army. Very disciplined men, and they had their the 22-pound shield, and they had their sword, which at Caesar's time was just a little bit over 2 feet, and they had their the pilum, the javelin. They would throw that and then come in with their swords, and so you've got this organized, literally military machine, and we can talk about it or not how they would. there wasn't a lot of screaming and yelling, I'm going to kill you. And they just literally, it was like a science to them. It was a business. They would line up their youngest troops up front. They would fight for a while until they got tired, and then they would shift and move the other guys in, and they would just wear down, just chew up anybody in front of them. Whereas the Gauls are going to be just a whole bunch of crazy, some of the times drunken guys, and there's no discipline. They're not worried about supplies or logistics. And but even though Caesar's got that huge advantage, you know, he's just so outnumbered in the territory that he has to learn is working against him. I just thought it was really interesting. The science of the Roman military machine was just very impressive for that time in history.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that they'd sort of learnt via the Spartans down through Alexander. Right. You know, there's a lot of military science about that had come from those periods. But I also read that a lot of the weapons and helmets and designs of some of these things that the Romans had might have been based on things they had learned from the Gauls. That they had, you know, got these ideas for weapons and defenses and armor from the Gauls, but then, you know, Rome could just produce them en masse, whereas the Gauls
right.
couldn't or didn't for whatever reason. So the Gauls had their own sort of stuff, but they just weren't as efficient, as you say, as a military machine. I also thought it was interesting that a legion, just if people are trying to get their head around what a legion is...
Oh, right.
Tended to have about 5,000 men in a legion.
Wow.
Technically speaking, although, you know, depending on how many guys you'd lost, it could be as low as, you know, 1,000 maybe, but it was designed to be around 5,000. So you said he had four legions, 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th, so roughly about 20,000 men under his command in theory.
Right. I thought it was interesting that the bulk of the legionaries, excuse me, were Roman citizens. But as far as the auxiliaries that they used, the horsemen, the light horsemen, the archers, and the slingers, those tended to be of other nationalities. It was almost like, okay, you can fight with us, and you have the honor of dying for Rome, but you're not going to be in the main group. You're not going to be a legionary. You're not going to be in one of the legions. I thought maybe there was a bit of prejudice there, but they certainly willingly took those men on and used them. Caesar will end up using them very effectively. And here's one more thing I thought was neat. They like we do today with our armed forces, they didn't have specialized units. Everybody was a freaking legionary, but when it came time to dig something or build something or whatever, the people who knew how to do that would just peel off from their groups or from their legions, and they would go help. So some of them were good at digging or building earthworks or the catapult. But other than that, they were in with their legion, and they had their pilum, their shield, and their sword, and they would only go into their specialized units as needed. I thought that was very interesting. I would just assume that they would have their, you know, specialized units ready to go, but it was just literally as a needed basis.
Yeah, they didn't have an engineer corps or anything like that that would go and build bridges or fortifications or anything. Yeah, I think it's also important to understand too that, you know, we've talked, I think, in earlier episodes about how the earlier on in Rome's history, the armies were put together sort of the landed gentry. But at this stage, it's really not that case at all. Like, a lot of the army is put together by the poor that probably didn't have a lot of options, I suspect. You know, they may have seen the army as some sort of a career path or a way to participate in the spoils. They could come back and you know, provide their families with a better life. The a legionary received an annual salary of 125 denarii or 500 sesterci, which wasn't a lot of money, but, you know, it was actually probably less than you would earn as a laborer on a farm. But, you know, at least it was a regular income. And when you signed up, you didn't get, like, shore leave. What do they call it in the army? Not shore leave. You didn't get R&R. It was a thing. You went and did this, and you were gone for as long as the war went on. Years and years. I guess you must have had some opportunity to send some money back to your family somehow or for the pay to go to your family?
I think they had that. Right. I think they had a paymaster or whatever the proper term is, and that, and they did send money back. What I thought was interesting, taking what you just said about how they're not paid very much, you know, it's all relative. So if you get a good general, a generous general who's going to win a lot of booty and sell a lot of slaves and make a ton of cash, it's perfectly within his right to keep every denarii, sestertii, if he wants to. But if he wants to parcel it out, he's suddenly going to have a very large group of extremely loyal men with weapons, and that's going to come in big later when we get to the Civil War.
And the other interesting thing that I read about this period is that the picture that people probably have in their mind of what a legionary or a centurion looked like in Caesar's time, mm-hmm. as a result of, you know, endless Hollywood films.
Hollywood, yeah. What sorry, was, I just burst out. I'm sorry.
What was that?
Oh, the movie 1941. Remember the Japanese battle? Hollywood. Sorry, that was completely inappropriate.
Wow.
I bust that out whenever I can, and I apologize to everyone.
Yeah, look, it's I'm the one who does the crazy shit. As
yeah, so just edit that out.
Hold on. As that reviewer, sorry. As that negative review said, One can only take so many non-jokes and an idiot cracking up at these non-jokes to just turn this podcast off. So I'm assuming that you're the idiot.
Obviously.
Laughing at my non-jokes.
Well, I just do that to make you feel good because
I know.
That's what friends are for. But
I know.
But if you can
that.
Get his address, I'd like to pay him a visit with my pilum and my sword and shield.
I thought you were going to say you're going to send him a mug.
No.
But this is this guy also said, yes, humor is good and can lighten up a history podcast. However, references to movies made 20 years ago is not a joke.
Oh.
What movie?
You, buddy.
What?
Well, I just referenced an older movie by you know, 1941, which is a classic. So he can go jump off Tarpeian and Rock or whatever.
What movie was he referring to? Did we talk about a movie in a previous episode?
I don't know. If someone could email it, if someone knows the answer to that and could email that to me, that'd be great because I really don't know.
But then he finishes the negative review by saying, if you like Family Guy, you may like this podcast. Like, that's an insult.
Oh,
I mean,
it's not.
Personally, I said giggity because I think Family Guy is awesome. Stop laughing at my bad jokes.
Good for you.
Long jokes, right?
Sorry.
So getting back to Hollywood. We think of, when I think of a centurion from this era or a legionary, I think of them wearing, you know, sort of armor and helmets and shields. Apparently, they probably would have had mail armor rather than, you know, big, heavy leather or plated armor, and a bronze or sometimes iron helmet. The Roman helmets left their eyes and ears uncovered, but had big sort of wide cheek pieces. They weren't enclosed helmets, which you would have seen in previous times, because the legionary needed to be able to hear orders barked at him. So his ears were left uncovered, which probably, you know, led to a lot of Van Gogh ears, I imagine, swords and shit and ears and all that kind of stuff.
Van Gogh wasn't the first. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's right. They had these huge shields, as you said, probably semi-cylindrical or maybe sometimes rectangular, quite large, 4 feet high. They had to obviously cover them. You could use them as a weapon. You could whack people with your shield, butt them with your shield and knock them down or try and get them off balance. And the javelin, the pilum that you mentioned before, could be thrown with force. It had sort of a 4-foot wooden shaft. So for in metric, what's that about? Just under 2 meters, I guess. With a 2/3 of a foot iron shank. So a pretty big iron shank, which had a small pyramidal point. But if you could get behind that and throw that hard enough, it would go through your opponent's shield and hopefully into him. So that's, I don't know if I could do that.
That's intense.
Yeah. I mean,
well, even if the only, if the only first foot of the pilum goes through, that's all you need, because it's going through and he's probably close up to his shield and suddenly he's seriously wounded and there's one less person. So again, just a very, the science behind it is very, very impressive.
Yeah. All right.
Yep.
What now?
Should we talk about the Gauls?
Yeah, the Gauls.
The Gauls.
Gauls.
I thought it was interesting that they're pretty intense. I mean, they certainly, and you don't know how much detail to go into, but they certainly use the body parts of their victims to celebrate, to show how tough they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ouch. So, I mean, kill me. Okay, I get that. We're in war. But then if you're going to drag around my head or my arms or wear a necklace with part of my body, that's just mean. But that was a part of their culture, just to show how tough they were and to, obviously to strike fear. And I don't want to give away something very important that comes later. But at one particular point, when Caesar gets frustrated, he is going to show them that he is equally capable of being barbaric, if you will.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were pretty intense. But I thought it was interesting. They had no training. They didn't worry about logistics. Individual bravery was all that was mattered. But they didn't have that disciplined fighting unit that the Romans certainly had. They didn't worry about patrols, and they were just a mass of men going around. So even though their numbers are a lot larger than Caesar, he has the tiny body with a mighty heart, if I can borrow from Shakespeare, and it's really going to make a difference when he starts to engage these different tribes or whatever you would like to call them.
Yeah, and we have to remember too that, you know, Caesar may have had a smaller overall force, but it was one force. I mean, these, the Gauls weren't a people. They weren't a nation. They were hundreds and hundreds of tribes led by kings or chieftains. They had like any other nation of tribes like that, they probably had some similar customs and cultures, but they disagreed. They fought against each other. They weren't a unified force. And they had been occupied at this stage, as we said before, by Rome for, you know, a century, give or take, where they, you know, weren't allowed to, you know, unify or come together as a single force to push back the Romans. So, you know, it's can be fairly easy for a single force like this to go and take on a bunch of individual smaller tribes. Although, you know, then you get to the early 19th century when Napoleon's in Spain and we have guerrilla warfare, which obviously the Gauls hadn't invented guerrilla warfare yet. They didn't know how to take down a large force like this. But they were quite brutal. Obviously, a lot of what we know about the Gauls, we know from Caesar himself, although, you know, we had the Greek historian Strabo who had written or wrote a lot about, you know, what the current understanding was of these peoples a bit later on. But they obviously were the people of the Druids, which was sort of their religious and perhaps slash political leadership, who famously didn't write anything down. It was part of the Druidic
culture, custom,
school of thought that, well, that by not writing anything down, it's not that they couldn't, but they figured that, you know, they probably kept their power and kept their knowledge secret by not writing it down. But consequently, we know very little about the Druids and what they believe in. We do know that the Gauls were big into human sacrifice. Which, you know, Caesar was like, oh my God, they do human sacrifice. But, you know, we have to remember that it was only 50 years before this where the Romans were still doing human sacrifice. When they were being attacked by the Cimbri, they were still doing human sacrifice. So, and they were still, you know, quite happy to watch people to be killed for entertainment. So it's not like the Romans were that superior when it came to these things, but they, you know, Caesar did write that he was sort of horrified and shocked by some of the Gauls' practices. They would build these large wicker figures that were filled with people, like Wicker Man or Burning Man.
Right.
But they would fill them full of criminals or enemies and then just set the thing on fire. I mean, how about that?
But not only that, not only after would they set it in fire, but they would literally sit there and watch to see if the person screamed or yelled out, either in pain or asking for mercy, to see how brave they were. So even though they lit it, they didn't just walk away. They were literally, it was a test of courage or bravery to see how intense they were. But again, not to ruin anything, but in the future of this podcast, there's going to come a point where Caesar, again, getting frustrated, one of his legates happens to, how should I put this, like administering pain. And Caesar is going to use this particular legate when things get pretty tense for him. So again, he can write about the Gauls and their beliefs, but at certain points in this war, he is going to be able to more than match them.
According to Strabo, when the Gauls left a battle, they would hang the heads of their enemies from the necks of their horses. And when they got home, would nail the heads of their enemies to the entrances of their houses. And then they would... And then the enemies that you killed that were like high ranking, they would embalm their heads in cedar oil and, you know, just keep them around, give them, you know, put them on display in the house, embalmed heads. And they were quite proud of that. Hey, look what I've got here. I got a head. Yeah.
That's right. Don't mess with me. See my row of heads right here? I'm just saying, just look at the row of heads and keep your mouth shut. Yeah.
That's how you get ahead in life.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's right. Or lose a head.
So.
But anyways, yeah. So should we wrap up?
Oh, we're wrapping up?
No, I'm just asking. That's all I know about the entire Roman Republican Empire. I have nothing else to say for the rest of the podcast series.
All right. Well, we're only 46 minutes in. Like, we got some more stuff. Have you run out of notes? Sure. No?
What would you like to... I have officially run out of notes. What would you like to talk about?
Oh, well, if you've run out of notes, that's fine. I mean, I thought we were going to get into stuff, but we're just doing an intro to the Gallic Wars today, are we? Hello?
Yeah, and again, we just want to – yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay, and again, I just – okay, watch the attitude. And I just wanted to say, again, for those people who are not big Caesar fans, this is where he – kind of deviates from the course of trying to get everyone to like him, and he is going to purposefully start a war to make himself the greatest known Roman general, politician, civilian, whatever you want to call it, throughout the ages. And he's going to do it at the expense of the people to the north of Rome.
I know that was your end of episode voice, but I do have another story I want to tell. Sorry.
You go right ahead. I just like being dramatic.
Yeah, I know you do. and the people love you for it, Ray. They say you have no personality. I don't get that.
I have a dramatic personality.
One of the main exports out of Gaul was wine. Ooh. You know, we think of France as the home of France, and Italy is the home of wine. And this was true back then. It is estimated that during the first century BC, 40 million wine amphorae were traded in Gaul. Now, an amphorae is, think of it like a massive jug, probably like, a couple of meters high or a couple of feet. It was 3-4 feet high, I think they were, full of wine. 40 million of those during the first century BCE. So wine was a big deal back then. And it's said that a Gaulish chieftain would exchange a slave for a single amphora of wine.
Mm.
So I don't know if that means that wine was valuable or slaves were cheap.
Or a little bit of both. Who knows?
Yeah, but so wine was a big deal back then, in that period. So again, Caesar's gone into this area and it's full of wine. I mean, So I thought that 40 million, I thought that was a huge number. There's a lot of wine going on back then.
Yeah, so basically it's its own economic center, and he wants control over it because he wants these people to be paying taxes, and plus he needs a lot of money for himself. That was not my wrapping up voice.
Can you do your wrapping up voice for me now? I'm finished now. I'm
okay.
I'm spent.
Yeah. So Caesar is going to do what he needs to do, whatever he needs to do for himself, for his legacy, and for Rome. How was that?
That was good.
You don't have to like it. You can be honest.
No, you crack me up, dude. I don't know how you do that. That's very good. And for you've got the voice. And for Rome.
I do it a lot at the end of each of my other shows, so I get lots of practice.
Oh, okay.
In case you noticed we didn't give away a mug, it's because we only give it to the people that really pretend to like us. And so if you want to be in the shot for a free mug, please send us please put a nice review on iTunes. Something like that, you know? A little PS after the episode.
I just recorded you saying that, so I'll just use that.
Oh, my God.
It'll work. Yeah. Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, well...